last week's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
To see the Capitol just destroyed, a symbol of our democracy, of our republic, destroyed the way that it was.
The second impeachment of President Donald Trump.
I think one of the most dangerous dynamics is how many people have been willing, without a shred of evidence, to just support the big lie that somehow this election was stolen.
Threats of violence around the country.
There are calls to action to domestic terrorism groups.
Next week's inauguration of the 46th President of the United States. NMSU government professor Dr. Krista Slayton joins us next to help put it all in perspective. And your calls and questions and thoughts are welcome at 575-646-2212. Voice of the Public will begin right after NPR News on KRWG Public Media. It's 106. Welcome to Voice of the Public from KRWG Public Media. This is Casey Counts. We're happy to have you with us this afternoon. And interested to hear what you have to say about the week that was, from last Wednesday's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol to the second impeachment of President Donald Trump to next week's inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden. And here to help us put it all in perspective and to help answer your questions, NMSU government professor Dr. Krista Slayton. Welcome to Voice of the Public.
Thank you.
Glad to have you back. I guess the last time you were here, you said, was to talk about voter suppression. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
And to have that conversation, you said, I believe it was before the election.
Yes.
And then to go into this topic of you know, election fraud, we've talked about voter suppression versus election fraud, was one of those topics that was kind of on the list of things to get to today, because we have these claims of voter fraud that President Trump started making many months ago. What's your interpretation of how that claim developed into what we saw last Wednesday, or is it responsible?
Well, the president long argued that if he did not win the election, it'd be because there was massive voter fraud. So he set up a situation which, if he was not reelected, he had already made the case that it was going to be because of voter fraud. So when the election results came out, he was very surprised that not only did he lose the election, but what had happened is that as the vote count came in, most of the vote count came in came from same-day voter registration. And as the absentee ballots came in, it began to shift from Trump being ahead to Trump being behind. And this is one of the things that gave a lot of credence to those who are arguing that something was wrong with the vote tally. Something was wrong with how did he go to bed at night thinking he's ahead and then all of a sudden he's way behind. So it just this was a scenario that he had argued before the election that he could only lose through voter fraud.
Do you expect that was something that, you know, he knew going in, because we knew that this election would be different than any other that we've seen in our lifetimes because of the pandemic?
I do believe there is a segment of the population that is very concerned about absentee balloting and that there are all kinds of ways in which fraud is committed through absentee balloting. That's been a long-held belief even before President Trump was elected to office. And so what we also have is we have a pandemic where people are voting in different ways than they normally voted. So some of the states changed some of the rules and procedures about how voting was conducted. So there are just a number of variables that contribute to this idea that there's massive voter fraud with absentee balloting or voting early, and just kind of fed a dynamic that all the other pieces came to play that kind of fit that narrative.
And I believe, we know that New Mexico's second district congresswoman, Yvette Harrell, was among those who voted against certification. And here's a little bit of what she had to say, giving her very first speech on the floor of the House.
The Democrat Secretary of the Commonwealth and the Democrat-controlled Pennsylvania Supreme Court usurped the constitutional authority of the state legislature. Together, they exceeded their authority by extending the deadline for absentee ballots and by waiving signature requirements for those ballots. In their haste to make these changes, the Secretary and the court created two different unequal standards for voters. Pennsylvanians who chose to vote in person still had to have their signatures verified at their polling place, but those who chose to vote by mail did not. How is this process fair?
Can you give us a little bit of analysis of those claims?
Well, not only is she making the claims about the elections officials did things incorrectly and state legislatures did things incorrectly, but the courts did things incorrectly. And I think that what we have to rely upon in this country is that we have three different branches of government, and they have assessed these accusations and they have deemed them to be invalid. And so at what point do you accept the process that we have established in this nation for resolving conflict? And at what point do you keep making the argument over and over and over again when you have no other legitimate authority doing that? So I just don't think there are grounds for challenging this election at this point.
575-646-2212 is the number to call on Voice of the Public. And you can ask questions. Government Professor Dr. Krista Slayton here with us today to answer those questions. Or if you just have thoughts you want to share about the events that have taken place over the last week and a half, we invite you to call and do that. 575-646-2212. You can also follow along on Facebook. We stream the show on Facebook and are happy to take your comments and questions there as well. And so we want to thank everybody for spending some time with us here today. And we've also got some comments that we're going to get to along the way from Senators Martin Heinrich and Ben Ray Lujan, who were, of course, both there that day and have some thoughts to share. But I wanted to ask you first, Dr. Slayton, as you were watching these events unfold, what were your thoughts? Did you anticipate that there could be violence on January 6th?
I definitely anticipated that there would be violence on January the 6th. It was publicly discussed frequently, and it was organized over social media, and why the Washington, D.C. did not have more people present for that day is just beyond my wildest imagination.
We saw an article that indicated that the outgoing Capitol Police Chief did ask for additional help from the National Guard several times and was denied that help. How deep can this go, or is there just a simple explanation that we're told bad optics was the reason that they didn't want to do that?
You know, bad optics is one thing, because you had the Black Lives Matter incident where there was an overuse of force, and a lot of innocent people were hurt. So I think that was one aspect of it. But the other thing is that when you have so many different levels of service that are trying to solve the same problem, sometimes there's a communication gap. Sometimes there's a gap in understanding and appreciating the seriousness of what's going to occur. So I think there are going to be congressional investigations that are going to be bipartisan, and I think everybody really wants to know where was the breakdown. Kind of embarrassing when you see those images of our nation's capital broadcasted around the world when we present ourselves as the great democracy in the world, that it's pretty embarrassing for all of us. And I'm sure there'll be some investigation about what really went wrong. Right now, I think it's premature to say.
We have Karen holding on the line. Welcome to Voice of the Public. Thank you for calling. Karen, go ahead with your question.
Hi. Yes, regardless of what protest this was, I've been hearing a lot of rhetoric about, well, if it was Black Lives Matter, they would have been shot. But at the same time, this didn't take place at the Capitol, this Black Lives Matter stuff. And nonetheless, I'll get around to my question. They breached the Capitol, they breached it, but you do not mow down American citizens, which is why I think a lot more people weren't killed. So my question is, being that a lot of us feel that Donald Trump did incite this, is it possible that he may never be able to run for president again, if all the lawsuits go as we're hoping? And that's my question. I'll take it off.
Thank you, Karen.
Well, what's going to happen is that he's already been impeached by the House of Representatives, and the trial is going to go into the Senate. And if he's convicted in the Senate, he will never be able to run for office again, which is one of the aspects of the impeachment process, where they, not the impeachment process, but the trial process, they can deem him ineligible to ever run for office again. And there are a variety of ways in which that can happen. They can even do that without convicting him. They can even pass legislation that says that he'll never be able to run for office again. And part of that also comes not just from the impeachment process, but comes from Amendment 14 of the U.S. Constitution.
I'm glad that Karen got us onto that topic, because I wanted to get your thoughts on what we're going to see from the Senate after the second impeachment of President Trump.
I think it's going to be very difficult to meet the standard of having all the Democrats and independents voting to convict the president, as well as an additional 17 Republican senators. I've not seen any indication there are 17 senators that are open to that. However, it's very unusual also that Mitch McConnell, who has been a strong supporter of the president, has now said that he's open to hearing the arguments and he's open to listening to the facts that are presented during the arguments. So this is a very unknown process that's coming up, because in the first impeachment of Donald Trump, all the Republicans voted in support of Donald Trump. In the House impeachment process that just passed, 10 Republicans, including the third-ranking Republican in the House, voted for impeachment. So this is a very different scenario. Lots of investigations taking place right now. Lots of evidence going to be presented, and it really is quite unknown whether or not the Republicans will also go along with Democrats and choose to convict him.
I want to get back to what the Senate might do in just a little bit, but, and I might jump around, so forgive me if I do that throughout the course of the rest of this hour. But we have some comments from both Senators Benry Lujan and Martin Heinrich about that day, and I just want to take a listen here to one of the things that Senator Lujan had to say. If I can get over here real quick, here we go.
To see people come together, you know, these thugs and this very violent attack on our republic, on our nation's capital, storm the United States Capitol. There's been so much reflection that this has only happened twice in our nation's history. You have to go back to the War of 1812 and now January 6th of 2020. Where people went in, people were killed, people lost their lives. And this all happened after President Trump called on his supporters to be in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, which was the day that the electoral votes would be counted in the U.S. Senate and in the U.S. House. And at 11 a.m. on Wednesday morning, which was yesterday, the president held a large rally at the ellipse of the White House and then called on that group to march to the U.S. Capitol and to say that Republicans that did not support him, that they were weak and that people should be held accountable. And after this attack on the U.S. Capitol began and the storming took place and the Capitol was overtaken after windows being shattered and offices being destroyed and people losing their lives, President Trump still would not call for those people to back down. As a matter of fact, it took some time. And only after Leader Schumer, Speaker Pelosi, President-elect Biden, even Vice President Pence, Mitch McConnell, and others condemned what was happening, it seemed like hours later that President Trump finally said to that crowd to go home. And even then, those words seemed to ring hollow. This is just not right. And I was already disappointed in this president, but now we're seeing a call from Democratic members, from Republicans across America, for the president to step down, for the 25th Amendment to be invoked. We're now seeing cabinet members that were appointed by President Trump resigning, leaving, walking away because of their disgust and disdain for what we saw yesterday. It was a very bad day.
Do you think those cabinet members resigned in disgust over what happened that day? Or could it be related to what their role would be if the 25th Amendment were invoked? Dr. Slayton, I'm sorry, I'm coming back to you.
Oh, excuse me. You know, well, some of them stated very clearly that they walked away because of how he handled January the 6th. So the first two cabinet secretaries that resigned said that was the turning point for them. So I don't think there's any doubt that he's lost some. And Mick Mulvaney, who was also in his White House office and become the envoy to Ireland, also a big supporter of Trump's, said he had gone too far. So no doubt that was a factor in some of the resignations.
Tell us how the 25th Amendment would work. Obviously, Vice President Mike Pence, Trump's most ardent supporters who were there that day, it seems like he was their last hope. And then they turned on him all of a sudden. What did they think he would be able to do?
Well, they thought he could do something, but he doesn't have the constitutional authority to do. So that day, he's just the presiding officer. He's not. If there's a challenge to the certification that comes from the states, he can then have senators and representatives speak to that. He has no authority himself to overturn anything. And the other thing is that there were no challenges coming from the states. All the states certified their slate of electors. So no state challenged their own elections, whether it came from a Republican state or a Democratic state or a Republican governor. So they kept thinking that he could kind of say, this is not acceptable and we're going to postpone the certification process. He has no legal grounds for doing that. So I think it took a lot of backbone on his part to stand up and say, I can't do this. But he did the right thing. And in terms of the 25th Amendment, what would have to happen is that he would have to convene the members of the cabinet and get at least half of those members of the cabinet to say that the president is incapacitated and the president is unable to fulfill the duties of president. Mike Pence has indicated that he cannot say that. He doesn't believe that the president is incapable. He might not like what the president does, but he says, I can't conclude that. The other complicating factor is because there have been cabinet resignations since January the 6th. Would you look at the cabinet in totality, or would you look at only those cabinet officers that have remained who were once confirmed by the Senate? So there's some gray area in there about, even if Mike Pence were willing to go along with this, how many members of the cabinet would he actually have to have on board to go along with this? I don't think 25th Amendment is going to be an option.
No, and that that interview with Senator Lujan was recorded by Fred Martino the very next day. So at that point, there were still more options. One of the things we learned since then was when Congress really wants to get something done, they can get it done pretty fast, right?
Yes, they can.
I wanted to compare the first impeachment of President Trump to the second. What should we take away from each of those experiences? And obviously a historic second impeachment. How will history treat these events?
Well, you've got two very different sets of scenarios. So there are a variety of differences between the first and second impeachment. So the first big difference is the charges. In the first impeachment, he was charged with two different violations. One is abuse of power and one is obstruction of justice. This one is a much more serious accusation. This is called incitement of insurrection. In the first impeachment, you had not a single Republican that supported impeachment. This impeachment process ended up with 10 members of the Republican Party supporting the impeachment process. It also, so you've got a bipartisan situation in the second one as opposed to the first one. Also, it's a process. You mentioned that if Congress wants to get things done quick, they can. In the first impeachment process, they had the Judiciary Committee investigate, bring witnesses, et cetera, before they took it to the full House for debate and for vote. In this situation, they bypassed the Judiciary Committee and they went straight to a House vote after having members of the House speak in favor and opposed to it. And also, when we look at the two different, we've got party shifting control here. So the Democrats are now going to control the Senate So the first part of the conviction process would be controlled by Republicans, and then the very next day, the Senate is going to switch over to being controlled by the Democrats. So you've got a lot of different changes that are going to take place here. And also, you've got Mitch McConnell, who, as I indicated earlier, a very strong supporter of the president, is now saying he's open to hear the arguments. In the first impeachment, he said he already made up his mind.
Mm-hmm. 575-646-2212, the number to call. You're listening to Voice of the Public on KRWG Public Media with NMSU government professor Dr. Krista Slayton, who I learned, is it for air, the announcement that you made to me over the telephone?
Yes, you can.
That you will actually be retiring after this semester. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Another interesting thing about this particular impeachment was that they also how did they treat the call to the Georgia Secretary of State, Raffensperger, with regard to the impeachment?
Well, that's another factor. This is one of the most troubling aspects of what's been going on. So what happened January 6th is just part of an ongoing process. The Secretary of State in Georgia is a diehard Republican, supporter of President Trump, voted for President Trump, but Secretary of State in many states are oversee elections. And so the president called him and asked him to find him enough votes to win the presidency. And he said, I simply can't do that. What's really troubling about the Georgia situation is that the elections officials in Georgia, both those who are elected in partisan elections and those who are appointed or those who are civil servants, began to receive death threats because they indicated that the election had not been won by President Trump. They had been won by President-elect Joe Biden. And that's one of the most troubling aspects of what we're facing right now. It's not just what happened to the Capitol. It's what's happened to hardworking, sincere, patriotic Americans who are receiving death threats for just doing their job.
We have Yvette holding on the line with a question or comment, I should say. You're welcome to just kind of share your feelings as well about the events of the last week and a half. Yvette, welcome to Voice of the Public.
Hi, thank you. I really kind of have some comments, and it's going to sound like a long walk, but the things that happened at the Capitol didn't just happen last week. If we look back, Timothy McVeigh was a right-wing extremist, and he blew up with others the Capitol, the federal building in Oklahoma. And that was in the 90s. And then we've had mass shooting incidents. We've had these extremists that shot up a Sikh temple, and they have shot up mosques, and they have shot up synagogues, and they have shot up black churches. And those are all these people who are these extremists. And this summer, the president encouraged people to go to the Capitol in Michigan and take over the Capitol. So this doesn't just happen in 1 week. It doesn't just happen in one incident. And even after all of this stuff happened, and it's, are they going to impeach him, he went to Texas. And when he was talking, he said, be careful what you wish for. And that's a threat. That's another threat. In his debate with Biden, he said, Proud Boys, stand by. This has been happening. It didn't just happen on Wednesday. And if people stop and think about these things building up, our country is headed in the wrong direction, but it's headed there on a long time. And when we have people that say, you know, our elected officials that say, this election was wrong, this election was stolen, President Trump started that with Hillary. When he was running for president against Hillary, if Hillary wins, it's going to be fixed. It's going to be fake. There's something wrong. Unless I win. He started that when he first started in 2016. And he's carried it on until now. This didn't just start.
Regular
people just need to stand up and realize that.
Thank you, Yvette.
Thank you for letting me just say that.
Sure. We're glad you called. That was one of the things on my list, Dr. Slayton, is the violence at the Capitol and how it developed. And the question I had for you is it truly political in its nature?
I think that Yvette made some very sound points, and I think that if you look at the statements that FBI Director Chris Wray has been saying for a long time, he's been saying to Congress for quite some time, the most significant threat we have to our nation right now is domestic violence, domestic terrorism. For a long time, law enforcement has been asking Congress to give them the legislative tools in order to allow them to investigate these domestic terrorist groups. And this has been going on for decades. This has been building. Some individuals have been stockpiling weapons in preparation for a revolution, in preparation for what they believe is, you know, a government that they no longer support. So this is something that was going to be reiterated, I'm sure, in the investigations that come out, that domestic terrorism is a very serious threat to democracy, and we need to do more to investigate it. We need to do more to stop it.
Senator Martin Heinrich touched on a little bit about, I think, what reflects Yvette's comments. Let's listen.
We watched that from on television screens in a secure location.
And here he's talking about the president holding that rally and talking to his supporters before they went to the Capitol.
That was largely made up of Republican and Democratic members of the Senate. And I can tell you there was just an enormous amount of, are you kidding me, just disappointment. And you know, there are definitely supporters of President Trump, including in the House and Senate, who I think will never break with him. But I saw many people who had defended Trump for quote, being Trump in the past, who got just how dangerous he is, how he has no remorse for any of these activities. And I think it's important to realize that even more dangerous than him inciting this mob was his willingness to create the big lie that led to this mob being in Washington, D.C. in the first place. And I think one of the most dangerous dynamics is how many people have been willing, without a shred of evidence, to just support the big lie that somehow this election was stolen. And when you have to prove actual facts in a court of law, again and again and again, this has been shown to be false. But conspiracy theories take root and they have consequences, and people die as a result. And I'm deeply worried at how many people, including people in very important positions of leadership, have been willing to enable that behavior by the president.
Ryan shares his comment or question on Facebook. This election season, we had so many fabricated statements that made us question the outcome of our elections. What are some of the ethical ramifications for elections moving forward? And what role do elected officials play in assuring the American public that our elections are fair and valid? Dr. Slayton?
Well, you know, I've worked with elections and voter registration officials for many years when I taught at Auburn University. I went around the country trying to professionalize that field and doing a lot to talk about the history of elections, the problem with corruption in past elections, processes that could be used. And really what we have these days in most locations are highly trained professional class of individuals, even Secretary of State who are elected in partisan elections. Most of them are committed to having fair and free elections. So I think we can have confidence, for the most part, with elections officials across the United States. They really take an oath also to defend the Constitution. I thought it took enormous courage of Republican elections officials who themselves were disappointed in the outcome of the election to stand their ground and indicate that elections have been conducted in a fair process. I think what happened is not the administrators of elections. It's been the politicians who have participated in a narrative that brings a lack of confidence in our political institutions, in our governmental institutions. And it's such a tragedy that people politicize something when we really do have a wonderful country with a wonderful process of elections. I think we should celebrate the fact we had more people vote in this election than in any election previously. We had record turnouts. We had record turnouts from young people getting involved and getting engaged. This should be a time for celebration of elections administration officials, not a time of condemning them. So I hope that some of these politicians that have questioned the legitimacy of the outcome of the election understand they're doing harm to our democracy when they question that process. We have so much that went well in this process for it to be turned around and used as something that's one of the worst elections. We had the head of cybersecurity saying it's the safest election we have ever had in the United States. We had, you know, Christopher Wray, who also said that. We had Bill Barr, the attorney general appointed by Donald Trump, who said there might have been some irregularities here and there, but nothing on the scale that some of these political leaders were saying happened. So I really think it goes back to political leaders have a responsibility to tell the truth and not to raise not only fear about a particular election, but distrust in our democracy itself. And if we can't believe our courts, we can't believe our legislators, we can't believe the top people who are administering elections, if we've lost confidence in that, then we've lost our democracy. And frankly, with the events of the last week, for all the trauma that we experienced, I think that we see a healthy democracy in many ways when people said, we've had enough and we're not going to be divisive in this fashion anymore. We're going to pull together in a bipartisan way, and we want a better way of doing things.
575-646-2212, the number to call if you have a question for NMSU government professor Dr. Krista Slayton, or just some thoughts to share regarding the events over the last week and a half. You mentioned, you know, we should be celebrating historic voter turnout. There are a lot of things it feels like we should be focused on. For example, the historic Senate Georgia races and the first woman vice president, a woman of color. Talk about those things in the context of, obviously they are overshadowed, but still significant and worth noting and worth celebrating.
Well, and also we voted in a pandemic, and we had extremely high voter turnout during the middle of a pandemic. We had elections officials in states all across the United States, including the state of New Mexico, where they did everything they could to educate us, to create a process by which we would be safe, where they encouraged voter turnout, where they made things easier for us to do rather than putting hurdles before us. That is a fantastic accomplishment. As you point out, we have the very first woman elected vice president of the United States, a woman of color also, and another great reason for many people. We're celebrating last year we celebrated the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. It took 100 years, but we finally got a woman in one of the highest offices of the land. We also should celebrate the fact that we've got young people engaged and involved in a way that we haven't had in a very, very long time. It's exciting to be teaching during this time period. My students are concerned about the environment. They're concerned about getting the facts before they vote. They're very activist-oriented. No matter what their major is, they have an interest in what's going on in our political world. They understand how that impacts their own lives. So as a professor, it's tremendously exciting to be working with these students. We also were able to adapt to really extraordinary circumstances with the pandemic, create safe ways for people to vote. We were overrun in the state I don't know about that, but Doñana County had more volunteers than they could even accommodate for the election. So there's so many different things that we should be celebrating, and that's kind of getting lost in this focus on people questioning the legitimacy of the election.
Indeed. Let's talk a little bit about next week's events and what you expect this inauguration to look like. Will it be unique in our history?
It's kind of shocking to look at. So I was going to Washington, D.C. for the inauguration. I had my airline ticket. I was supposed to leave on Sunday, and I was going to be there until Friday. So I've changed those plans for whether or not the decisions to be made that there will be no no people allowed on the National Mall. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be approximately 20,000 National Guard troops there. When you look at pictures of the Capitol, which I visit frequently, I love this, the Capitol area. It's exciting and thrilling, and there's a real sense of history to me. And you look at all the buildings are blocked off, streets are blocked off. It's surrounded by National Guard. They're sleeping inside the Capitol to protect the Capitol. So that's very unusual. The last time we had troops inside the Capitol on a round-the-clock basis was during the Civil War. And they slept there. They had hospitals there. They cooked there. They, you know, did a variety of things. President Lincoln actually went and visited them while they were. But that's the last time that we've had troops in the Capitol. They're discouraging people from coming to the inauguration. So whereas President Trump was really concerned with how many people showed up at the inauguration, President Biden is not going to have the possibility of having large turnout to see him inaugurated. Although I understand that he's still going to have take the oath outside, and that will be our tradition.
Are you supportive of that idea? Do you think it's the right thing to do?
About having the inauguration outside?
Yeah.
Yes, keep us safe, and I've listened to lots of analyses, and they've learned a big lesson from what happened January the 6th. I think they have all the law enforcement agencies working together, the Secret Service, the FBI, the local police, the Capitol Police. I think they've worked out a system. I think that if they didn't think it would be safe for him to do so, I think that they would really speak out and discourage him from doing it. So I think that'd be a nice event for that to happen for him. But at the same time, we're going to have the inauguration. We're probably going to be having the trial of the President Trump at the same time. So it's kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the Civil War being the last time that there were troops in the Capitol. Wow. And never has, to my knowledge, the Confederate flag been flown around in the Capitol.
Yeah, that was really shocking. You know, I've indicated to my students, pay attention to what's going on right now, because your grandchildren are really going to want to know, because there's so many things that are happening so unusual. I grew up in the South. I lived in the South for 20 years. I went back and worked in the South after I got my degree at the University of Hawaii. So my family is from the South, and I saw lots of Confederate flags. What surprised me tremendously was the state of Mississippi chose to change its flag. But there's been a lot of sensitivity to what that flag represents, the Confederate flag represents. There's been a lot of movement to take away that image for many of kind of segregation, slavery history that we have in this country. So after so many states that were part of the Confederacy to change how they do things, to take Confederate flag down from the state capitol, and then to see it inside the capital of the United States was pretty shocking.
575-646-2212, NMSU government professor Dr. Krista Slayton, spending the hour with us today for Voice of the Public, and a chance for you to share your thoughts. If you have a question, please call now, and we'll get that in for you. You can also follow along on Facebook, and we thank you for participating any way that you can and would like to. I wanted to share some more comments from our senators. First, Martin Heinrich on just the experience that day. And he, by the way, had this interview with Fred Martino. It was just broadcast last night on KRWG-TV on Newsmakers. And you will have another opportunity tomorrow evening at 5 p.m. on KRWG News This Week to hear this full interview. But again, here's just some comments on his experience that day.
You know, I had actually just left the floor of the Senate to go downstairs to make a phone call in the basement of the Capitol, and was in the hallway getting ready to go into an office there and make a phone call when the first Capitol police officer who had been injured, who had been maced in the face, was basically being carried, walked down the hall, sort of half carried, half on his own 2 feet, right at the very beginning of this. So I was aware of the situation a little earlier than most of my colleagues. At that point, I went upstairs and began to let my colleagues know that it appeared that the Capitol Police just simply did not have the numbers, and that this situation was going to become very difficult to manage very fast.
And I'm sure this is something you never imagined that you would ever face in such a building that it should be so secure.
You know, so much of what I was acting on then, that at that point, was based on seeing this officer who had been attacked and hearing the radios go off on the belts of other Capitol Police in the hallway. And it was clear that they had lost the perimeter at that point. I went back out to the window because I wanted, you know, I think it was hard for some of my colleagues to process the urgency. I went back off the Senate floor and looked out the windows that faced to the west of the Capitol, that faced the mall and also the scaffolding structure where the inauguration is to take place. And at that point, it was pandemonium. I mean, it was a mob of completely unruly, uncontrolled, huge numbers of people climbing on the Capitol, climbing on the scaffolding that we used for the inauguration, beginning to rush the building itself. There were Confederate flags being waved and Trump flags being waved. And at that point, I realized that, you know, it was only a matter of time until the Capitol was going to be breached. And I basically had to decide between trying to shelter in an office there or go back to the floor with my colleagues and try to press the case that this is getting completely out of hand. So I went to the floor of the Senate and said, you know, it's only going to be a matter of time before the Capitol is breached. And within minutes, an announcement was made that people were inside the building. It wasn't that long after that until another announcement was made that apparently shots had been fired. We were not sure whether those were, you know, whether those were rubber bullets or real bullets in trying to push people back out of the building. It was from that point on, it was really sort of pandemonium, and all the doors to the Senate floor were closed to secure that location until the point at which the Capitol Police moved the members from the floor to a separate secure location. It was, you know, having had a chance to travel in places where tensions are high and people are armed, it was really, it was something to see.
575-646-2212, the telephone number. And we have a couple of callers waiting to get on Voice of the Public. Libby, you're next. Thank you so much for calling today.
Thank you. I have you on speaker. It's not going to create echo, is it?
So far, so good.
Okay. So, a couple things. We're hearing a lot about the 14th Amendment and the responsibility of those that helped echo and strengthen the message of a fraudulent election, and even about going and being, showing some strength at the Capitol on January 6th. How likely is it that some of those representatives are going to be brought to trial or held responsible for their actions? Second, we're talking about the inauguration. It's the nation's fairly divided right now, and that includes even within law enforcement and military personnel, which is kind of scary. I know that one of the big military leaders told all, I guess he's the head of all the military branches, and he says, you remember your oath to country. So that's kind of scary because we hear of situations at during the incidents on January 6th about some of these people walking in freely, and even active duty members of police and law enforcement as well as military. And then last, there's a law professor, a local law professor, that is still echoing and repeating, and I guess echoing, repeating same thing, the same sentiments that President Trump has said about fraudulent elections and, you know, and censorship and kind of driving that message still, you know, is that appropriate? How professional is that? Is that something to be a concern, we should be concerned about?
Well, thank you, Libby. Lots of territory to cover. Dr. Slayton, where do you want to start?
I saw that law professor. I think I know which law professor you're referring to. And I've read his messages and I've seen his videos. And what he's doing is that he's saying he's raising questions. He's not taking a stand. He's raising questions. Well, I have some answers for those questions. And my answer to those questions is that I trust the Secretaries of State. I trust law enforcement at the national level. I trust the authorities that investigated all of these incidents that the professor is talking about. And they have found no evidence to support President Trump's claims about fraud, massive fraud. They have found no evidence to say that Antifa was the one that started the riots in Washington, D.C. So the law professor claims he's not taking a stand. He's just raising questions. So he can do that as a law professor. When majority of individuals speak out against him within the university, that doesn't mean we're trying to silence speech. We're saying you don't have the evidence to back up what you're saying. In terms of people who are members of Congress who are supportive of the president, some of them are now apologizing that they went along with this kind of let's question the state certification process. Some of them have apologized for that. They've understood. There have been some accusations, I don't know how accurate they are, that some members of Congress might have been on the planning of the event. I think there will be thorough investigations that take place. And this is in the interest of both Democrats, Republicans, and also the independents that are in Congress. It's really important they find out who did what, when, where, how, in order to protect the safety of all of them. So I think we're going to see a lot of investigations into behavior that took place, and people have to account for some of the things that they've done. So I don't know if I've answered all your questions, but we don't have all the answers yet. But I do believe, just like we did after 9/11, I read the 9/11 Commission report, and there's so much data that's out there. And you have to look at every piece of evidence, and you have to come to some conclusions. And when it's all said and done, I think we'll get some really solid answers, and we will hold people accountable.
All right. And Jackie is also holding Voice of the Public on KRWG Public Media. Welcome to the program, Jackie. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. I am a staunch believer in the separation of church and state. I'm not saying that the representatives that I'm going to mention necessarily don't support that, but I am somewhat offended by Yvette Harrell. I also do not favor Steve Pierce. I feel these people don't really represent the people of the state of New Mexico. But my real concern is unsolicited mail I've received from some candidates that really do not convey accurate knowledge, but quote scripture and things like that on the front of a postcard. I am beginning to wonder what has happened to scholarship and statesmanship. The fact that, you know, it takes many years and a lot of years of study and public service to be a qualified candidate. And some of the material that I have received in the mail reflects that our current representation do not have these traits. I was wondering if there's a sources of information I'm not aware of that could investigate these things or try to exert a force against that kind of politicization of things. And my last comment is that I really feel that the world has an awful lot of people in it, and no one seems to be courageous enough to address the fact that some of these behaviors we're witnessing are sort of typical of what's usually called a super dominant species. It seems to me that a part of the problem we're having is that there limited, resources are limited, and there are too many people with real problems who need a source as a piece of the pie. So those are just some thoughts I wanted to put out. But I was also wondering if there's some way the professor knows of trying to push back against this lack of awareness of these kinds of things, particularly the separation of church and state and things like overpopulation when it comes to politics.
Well, Jackie, huge concepts to introduce when we only have 5 minutes left, but Dr. Slayton, I'll let you have a go at it.
Well, we are a country that has a First Amendment that gives people the right to say whatever they think, as long as they're not inciting insurrection. And so you're going to have people put out ideas out there that are not grounded in facts, that are not grounded in the experience that most of us has had. You're going to have people putting out conspiracy theories. One of the reasons why I feel more optimistic about our democracy is that I think a lot of people in this country are very open-minded and very willing to listen to other points of view, even when they don't agree with them, and are willing to have a variety of views expressed. But I think that we've seen a clampdown when we've seen certain Twitter refusing to promote things that incite violence. Twitter began to document this is not supported by, you know, the fact. This is not supported by, you know, government officials. They've indicated a lot of warnings, and now they've completely taken down some of the things that have become not just untrue, but things that really are promoting violence and so forth. So you also have some corporations now that are saying they're not going to donate money to those legislators that stood up and said they thought that the election was not valid. And so I think you're seeing some accountability now. So, if you know, in John Meacham's book, The Soul of America, he looked at different periods in our history in which we have really been through trauma. We've been through a civil war. We've been through a significant depression. We've been through so many different periods in our history, and we've come out of those. So he says there's always a tension in our lives between the politics of hope and the politics of fear. And it's up to American citizens to make sure they're attentive enough so that they hold elected officials responsible and accountable. And we may be duped for a while, as Thomas Jefferson would point out, but Thomas Jefferson said, we will come around and we will figure out that we need to know more and we'll become educated and we'll hold people accountable. So I do believe that we're in a time frame now where we're reassessing how we get our knowledge, we're reassessing how we disseminate our knowledge, we're reassessing this hyper-partisanship that we have, and we're trying to find out what unites us as Americans, not what divides us as Americans. And I believe through all this horrific experience that we have witnessed within the last month or two, I think that we're going to see a coming together. It's not going to happen overnight. I think we're going to see a coming together where we really assess what does it mean to be an American. What does it mean to support our Constitution? What does it mean to take an oath to defend our country? And we're really going to have some significant discussion about that. And we've got the attention now of all Americans. And when all Americans pay full attention, I'm confident that Americans choose the right path.
Let's see if we can squeeze in Diane, who's been holding patiently. Thank you for calling, Diane. Do you have a question?
Yes. I agree that, you know, all of our attention right now is focused on what's going on in the Capitol, in D.C. But I am concerned with the gal that brought up Yvette Harrell, whose base was clearly, widely, popularly supported by the Cowboys for Trump, who did storm the Capitol building, and also who was supported by the constitutional police and sheriff, who are an amendment to political organization, and, you know, who also catered to a lot of the vigilante interests on the border with regard to refugees and all of that. And I am concerned that she, after the insurrection in the Capitol, also did you know, support the vote to not forward Biden. So my question is, because that is local, because Yvette Harrell mm-hmm. came from Cloudcroft, is in the same town with the Cowboys for Trump, you know, has been really sort of partying with all of the people who were involved or that ilk involved with the Capitol insurrection. What are we doing in New Mexico to protect our governor and our own state government from these people?
That's a huge question, and let's see if we can get it answered in 30 seconds, Dr. Slayton.
I think our governor is very well aware of the fact that on the 17th there is a movement to try and have these protest rallies at state capitals as well as in the nation's capital. I think that people within the state of New Mexico will be on the lookout for that. And, you know, I think the her comments were very appropriate and something that we should not take our eyes off what's happening in New Mexico.
All right. Thank you so much for
the state capital.
Thank you so much for spending this hour with us, Dr. Slayton. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And NPR News is coming up next.